The Lima Coast to Coast, Show 23, April 5th, 2006. That will should be the whole of the law. Welcome to Thelema Coast to Coast. My name is John Crow, and I'm the host of the show. First, I want to apologize for the delay. I had meant for this podcast to come out on the 26th, and in fact, some of the conversations that I have with the guests kind of refer to that schedule. But unfortunately, due to some personal schedule issues, me actually being completely overwhelmed with work, school, and a bunch of other things, this has been completely delayed. So I'm getting this out now as I can. Also, I want to mention that this month, April, is the one-year anniversary of the podcast. So thanks to all the guests and listeners who have made this podcast such a success. I really appreciate it. The April 26th show is going to be my quote, celebration show. So if you have any comments or messages or anything like that, please send them in and they will be on that show. I really want to stress to people to call the voice listener line and leave a message that way. I would love to have those messages on the show for the 26th. I will give that number out in a little bit because I screwed up again and did not call the voicemail and they reset my number. So I have a new voicemail number once more. Nevertheless, another thing that I'm looking to do now that the podcast is a year old, I'm looking to promote the show in a print medium. So if anyone runs a newsletter or a magazine or website that is related to the occult, Thelema, magic, stuff like that, and they want to have an interview about the podcast or magic with me or something like that, I'm looking to promote the podcast in that kind of medium. In return, you get an interview and some content for your publication. So if you're interested in doing that, please give me an email, podcast@thelemacoasttocoast.com. Now, it is the 5th. And this weekend, starting with the 8th, is the Thelemic Holy Days. So I have three special shows planned for the Holy Days. On each of the days, I will be releasing a spoken or musical rendition of each of the chapters. So each show will consist of basically the opening, a brief description of the rendition, and then the rendition of each chapter, and that's it. So look for something a little different coming up this weekend. And then we will be returning to the schedule, the normal format, on April 26th. And again, I want to encourage people to send in messages for that. Back in December, Steve in the UK, who goes by the username OE on the website, recommended that I implement a Frapper map instead of saying to people that they should leave a message about what country they are and then mapping the country. At the time, I was not sure how to embed the code for that, and Frapper was still a bit in its infancy. Since then, Frapper has definitely matured, and a lot of people have been taking advantage of it. As such, I have entered a Frapper map on the front of the website, and so far, without even announcing it, we've got 37 people on the website, so thank you very, very much to everybody who's already signed up for that. One disparity I've noticed, though, is only three women have signed up for it, whereas 34 men have. And I know there's a lot more female listeners out there, so come on, ladies, get on the website and place yourself on the Frapper map and let people know that you're out there. Again, it is free to sign up for Frapper. And all you need to do is go to the Thelema Coast to Coast website. Right about halfway down the screen is the Frapper map, centered on the U.S., but you can be anywhere in the U.S. and put yourself on the Frapper map. We've already got listeners on there from Canada, Argentina, and a few other places. So it's quick and easy. All right. On this show, I'm going to be talking to Richard Kaczynski about his new book, Panic in Detroit. This has been released as the Blue Equinox Journal number 2, and is really an excellent book. It gives a lot of good background information about Crowley and his attempt to establish the OTO within the United States, and in particular in Detroit. Also, the efforts to get the Equinox 3-1 published and all of the things revolving around that. Dr. Kaczynski does a wonderful job of summing it all up with an introduction, and then the rest of the book is reprints of source material, including letters between Akkad, Crowley, and others, and also transcripts of the newspaper articles that were coming out regarding the scandal that arose at this time. So an excellent source book for material and also a great book for historical information. So I'll be talking to Dr. Kaczynski about that. After that, I have an interview with Keith Richmond about the Thelemite Ray Burlingame. Richmond and a partner of his have purchased Wiser Antiquarian Books, and recently they've acquired a number of Burlingame originals that go back to Crowley First Editions and some other first editions after Crowley's death. Those have been put on sale. By now, most of them have been sold. Nevertheless, there is a lot of information that Richmond gives us about the books, about Burlingame, and as well as they did a limited edition catalog for those who bought the book. So we talk about that. And lastly, I have an interview with Keith 418. We're talking about magical teachers, and in particular replying to a listener comment who asked some questions about that. But before getting into that, let me get into the listener feedback. I actually have quite a number of emails, so I'll try and go through those quickly. The first is from Mike. He says, 93, John. Just finished listening to your last podcast. Love the insights of Mr. Greenfield. As a member of the OTO and several branches of Freemasonry, I appreciate the honest comments about the craft. As I live and practice in Canada, some of the historical concerns mentioned vis-a-vis the racial minorities is less of an issue, but the contents about involvement of women is well said. There is no question that having women in a magical setting produces unique and powerful manifestations, otherwise unobtainable. I look forward to your next podcast. Love is the law, love under will. Mike. Mike, thank you very much. I really appreciate those comments, and I think you're right. It is very important that both sexes are involved. There is a necessity in the equality of genders for magical work, and by Masonry not having the female gender involved in the craft, it really does lose some things in it. So thank you for the comments. The next one is a longer email from Meredith, and is about the OTO dues. So I think there's some great insight in this, so I wanted to read the whole one, so have a little patience. John, I just finished listening to number 21, and the conversation that you had with Keith 418 about dues within the OTO concerns me. I am not an OTO member or Thelemite, but I am a practicing sadomasochist. The organized BDSM scene has all the same problems that you describe in the OTO, and I do love hearing you and Keith 418 process the politics and organizational dynamics on the podcast. Dues serve a surprisingly large number of functions, only part of which are funding the organization. One very important aspect that you only address peripherally is how dues function as a social filter. If members need to pay to join your club, only those for whom your club's worth equals $20 or more will show up. The higher your dues are, the higher the priority your organization has to be for the members to show up and pay. The example of your fast food employed lodge brother who shows up faithfully and pays his dues regularly is an excellent example. The fact that the OTO is not enforcing the dues is definitely a big problem. But when there is a moderate financial duty placed on the club members, it vastly improves the quality of the people that show up. I frequently say that I work very hard at keeping my home orgs from becoming, quote, a haven for the socially inept, close quote, and enforcing a membership tax on the members is a very powerful tool towards achieving it. Another detail I don't believe you have addressed, how concerned is the OTO with sheer numbers? In my experience, when a group becomes more concerned with the number of warm bodies at a given function than with the quality of the brains attending or the quality of the function itself, the dedication and quality of the people take a nosedive. Granted, from what I've been able to infer from your show, both these issues are fundamentally related to the fact that the OTO simply is not willing to take risk alienating a single constituency within its membership, and until the neutrality of the leadership is addressed, very little else will move forward. I simply wanted to chime in from an entirely different community and share the way we are addressing similar problems. As well, let's say that I absolutely love your show. On a more personal note, I went to Keith 418's Life Journal, and it was friends locked. He is certainly free to do whatever what he wishes with his little corner of the internet, but where can I find more of his opinions and writings? I find his critique of the subculture fascinating and very relevant to my own battles in the S&M world. Anyway, thanks for the great podcast. I look forward to many more in the future. First, quickly about Keith 418's journal. Yes, he keeps it locked because he wants to control the quality of the people that are in it and responding. He doesn't allow people without live journals to even look at it. You have to have a live journal, so no anonymous comments. And then even then, he wants people who actively write on their own journal and are just not voyeuristically going on his journal and commenting there. So if you really want to be on Keith 418's live journal, create a live journal of your own, start writing on it, request membership on his live journal, and he will either let you on or off. And it's kind of up to him. So that's kind of his policy on how he works with his little corner of the internet. Now, going back to the quality or quantity, I've actually brought this issue up myself with the OTO leadership, and they have said to me that they're not interested in quantity, that they are interested in, quote, quality. However, that's all very well and good that they can say that, but the reality is they actually are not really after quality or quantity. And if they were, they would be doing things a lot differently. So I think that really goes back to your point about the neutral leadership that needs to be addressed. So, and honestly, that comes from not having any goals and not challenging the membership and being more of a social organization than an actual magical fraternity that challenges the individual members to grow spiritually. So there's a whole lot of issues there, but I really do appreciate the comments that you sent in. All right, the next one is from Matt. He says, "Dear John, do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law." In response specifically to the listener who you quoted on your last podcast, scolding Keith for his critiques of the order and to Keith 418's discussions concerning the order in general, I would like to say that Keith's criticisms are providing what is currently a necessary service to an order whose potential is great and which, due to the failings of its own members, falling greatly behind. Keith is doing what we all should be doing, expecting great things of ourselves and settling for nothing less. His criticism is the fire under the OTO's figurative posterior and the force spinning and charging the battery of great change. Blessings to you and to him for giving a louder voice to such. Success is thy proof. Love is the law, love under will. Well, thank you very much, Matt. I really appreciate those comments. And I have forwarded that on to Keith, so he's gotten that too. All right, the next one is from Ryan. He says, "When I first heard Thelema Coast to Coast, I thought it was absolutely fantastic, and it just seems to get better and better. The mix of specific Thelemic issues, general occultism, and Crowleyanity makes the show an outstanding representative of Thelema and the online occult community. The obscure esoteric texts which make up the basis of Western occultism have been online for a long time, but the explanations and interpretations from experienced magical practitioners were always in short supply. This show is doing a lot to make magic in general, and Thelema specifically, accessible to people who are geographically isolated from other Thelemites and occultists, and does so with tact and grace. I know that you've devoted a lot of effort to this and other projects of such a nature over the years, and I want to offer my thanks and congratulations on this exquisite triumph. Ryan." Well, thank you very much, Ryan. I really appreciate the positive comments, and it is a lot of work. And in regard to your experienced magical practitioners, I do what I can, but I do think that there is also a significant lack of experienced magical practitioners out there. There seems to be a lot of beginners, but very few intermediate and advanced, and that's kind of a topic I will be addressing a little later. Okay, the next email is from a different listener named Matt. Do it the will should be the whole of the law. I'm currently listening to Thelema Coast to Coast number 14, specifically the portion about the Goetia, something I have yet to work with. Permit me a bit of background. My experience in Thelema and the writings of AC is limited, but growing quickly. It has been probably 6 months since I discovered Thelema, and I've only been seriously interested these past 3 months. I still consider myself a bit of a neophyte, if anything, although my knowledge grows every day. However, my problem is this. When I get it into my head that it is in my best interest to begin to do some magic, I am stopped by the absolutely overwhelming amount of material. I have come to the conclusion that since magic requires a disciplined mind, yoga is what I shall take to first. And once I have a firm control over my thoughts, I would then be ready for magical workings. However, as I sit here and listen to Keith's inspired lecture on magic, I notice that he is unrelenting in his criticism of the non-practicing. I share his sentiment fully, and yet cannot help but realize that I am more than a little hypocritical. I suppose what I'm asking you is, at what point should I begin practicing? At what point should I seek Minerval in the OTO? Would you recommend I attempt to find a mentor of sorts? Is this common in the OTO? Of course, I realize that these things are up to me, but as of right now, I would most appreciate an experienced opinion. I sincerely hope you have time to answer my questions. Thank you, Matt. Loves the law, love under will. Okay, Matt, I'll do my best to answer your questions. First, when to start? Now. It doesn't matter if you start out small and are just doing things like the lesser banishing ritual, the pentagram, or doing the lesser invoking ritual, the hexagram, doing the star ruby, doing any of these preliminary rituals. You can even just start out doing Libra Resh, but the whole point is you have to start practicing now. You don't have to be able to go and invoke goetic demons tomorrow. Start with the basic rituals. Start doing Libra Resh. Start doing the pentagram ritual. Start doing the middle pillar. Start doing these basic fundamental rituals. While you're doing those, start doing your yoga practices. You're not going to be able to still the mind if you can't sit still. So you need to start with your asanas. You need to start with your breathing practices. You need to start with your fundamentals and then build up. In regard to when should you join the OTO, that's completely up to you. The OTO is there as a service to you, and once you join, as you become a service to your brothers and sisters. So whenever you're ready to take that plunge, go do it. But in the meantime, I would recommend going and getting involved with your local body. Go meet the people that are there. Go to a Gnostic Mass. Go to some classes. Go to a talk. Get involved. Thelema is about individual development, but it is best done in an environment where you have peers that you can work with. That goes to your mentor of sorts. Should you have a mentor? Yes. But the next question is, what do you want to have a mentor for? If you're saying you want to have a magical mentor, that's kind of broad, and I don't know if you're going to be able to find it. So, I don't want to get too much into that because this is actually the topic that Keith418 and I talk about on the show. But should you have a mentor? Yes. But you need to get very clear within your mind what kind of mentor you want, what you want a mentor to teach you, and where and what you're willing to do to get a mentor. Keep all of that in mind, and when you listen to Keith418, we go into that a lot more. Okay, so I hope that answers your questions. Again, start practicing now. Work your way up to the harder stuff, the more complex, but you got to start with rituals now. You got to start doing your yoga, your asanas, your pranayama, all of your basic exercises. Start doing Libra Resh. Start banishing so that you can get control of your environment. Start doing the hexagram invoking rituals so that you can start invoking energies after you banish. These are the things that you really want to start with in the beginning. And they're things that are not that complex. On top of that, if you start going to an OTO body, whether you're a member or not, there's going to be a lot of people who can help you with those rituals, who can give you pointers. When you say, hey, when I'm doing the lesser banishing ritual, I'm doing the sign of the Enterer, but I don't know if I'm doing it right, or am I pronouncing these archangel names correctly? The OTO is a great resource. The people there can help you with that. So I strongly recommend that you go and get involved in a local body. You don't even have to take Minerval to do it, but if you find that the people there you are people you click with, hey, take Minerval. It's an introductory degree, no obligation. And if you find the OTO is for you, great, take more initiations. If the OTO isn't a fit, well, at least you gave it a try, and now you can go on to other things. Regardless of how you look at it, it always comes down to your practice. You gotta do something, and you gotta do it now. All right, so let me go to the next email from Dan. He says, just ran across your show and think it's great that you're doing this. While I'm not a Thelemite, your shows have a lot of interesting information, and I've found a couple I've listened to very entertaining. Right now I'm listening to the new one, and I'm almost in tears laughing every time I hear the dog wheezing. Anytime. Thanks for putting out a great show. Well, thanks, Dan. And I've gotten a few comments about the snoring dog from the last podcast. So, like I said before, I hope you all can overlook that and pay attention to the content. I think Greenfield has a number of interesting insights in that discussion. All right, the last feedback is from a listener named Will. He says, do what thou wilt should be the whole of the law. Dear John, first I'd like to thank you for doing the podcast. I have been studying Thelema for about a year now and have been a listener of the podcast from the beginning. You have helped me learn so much. I recently took part in my first Gnostic Mass and was baptized. Congratulations, Will. I will be receiving my Minerval degree in September, as well as being confirmed. I have a question regarding the magical journal. I found it to be a hard time for me at first because I did not know where to start with it. For example, I wasn't aware what needed or should be written in there. It wasn't until I found my current group master that I was told. My question is it possible that you may take a few minutes on your show and discuss a magical journal, its importance, and how it should be kept. Thank you for your time. I will always give my continued support to the podcast. Loves the law, love under Will. Will. The magical journal, that is a great, great subject. As far as I'm concerned, I put everything in my magical journal. Because I look at magic as an integrated part of my life and not something that I kind of segment over to a side, I see everything that I'm doing involved in my magical spiritual life. So what kind of day I've had at work, what kind of interactions I've had with a significant other, if I've had any fights, if I'm not feeling well, all of those seemingly mundane things I put in my magical journal because I think it gives a well-rounded view of where I'm at and what I'm going through at any particular time. I also keep a number of magical journals. Well, first of all, I have my written magical journal. So this is a journal I keep by my bed that I write in almost every day. I kind of summarize my day, summarize my practices, if I have any insights, if I've talked to anybody special, if I've done anything to move my projects forward. I record all of this in my journal. If I have any thoughts about magic or anything like that, I record it all. If I've done any magical rituals that day, I record that. And this is in addition to a different journal that I have that is specifically my ceremonial and magic journal that I detail all the technical aspects of the rituals that I do. But this is those journals now are more about if I'm doing Enochian or any other kinds of workings, I write them in that journal. If I'm just doing regular invocation or yoga work or any of that kind of stuff, banishing rituals and stuff, I just note it in my regular journal. One thing that I also do is I consider my email correspondence part of my magical journal. Now, this is something that I, as far as I can tell, is kind of unique to me. What I do is, after every year or so, I go back and I sort through all of my emails for the last year, compile the ones that are worth keeping, print them out, and have them bound. And that's also part of my magical journal. And the reason is because I have a lot of unpublished correspondence between Crowley, Akkad and others, Crowley and others, and when I read this material, I get a lot out of it. And I realize that very few people today are doing any kind of written correspondence. What they do instead is they do emails, they do blog entries. And that's another thing I do. I, at the end of every year or every 2 years, I take my blog and all the comments and all the pictures and I print those out and I have those bound too. So my whole attitude is all of these things that I'm doing, whether it's my emails, my magical practices, my mundane day-to-day things, they're all part of my journal. They're all documents and source material about what I'm doing with my life so that I can then go back to it and see where things are going. And do I go back and look at those emails and things like that? I can't say that I do it that frequently, but I certainly do it, and I certainly have that material available to me. So it just depends on how far you want to go. Let's see, some of the other journals I have, I also keep my calendars. I keep notes about what I'm doing with my schedule, so I keep my calendars as part of my magical journal. And I got that idea from going to the Harry Ransom Center, Crowley's 1904 journal. The one I looked at the Harry Ransom Center is a big day planner, but Crowley has a lot of notes in that. So I started thinking about using the day planner as also part of my magical journal. And then lastly, I have some specific journals about subjects. And like if I'm doing some research on a particular magical practice or a particular magical aspect, such as the Holy Guardian Angel. I have a journal where I have a lot of entries about that, which I'm doing some work on trying to reconcile some of the seemingly contradictory things about the Holy Guardian Angel and increase my understanding. So I have a journal dedicated just to that. So I'm a big journaler. I think that it is a very important aspect of the magical practice. I think it is something that you have to get disciplined into, and writing in every day if possible, if not, at least every few days. And I'm a person who puts everything in it. Now, conversely, if you go look at the magical journal of Fredo Akkad, you don't find his mundane life in it. And that was one of the things that I wanted to kind of pull out when I interviewed his son, Tony Stansfield Jones, on a very early podcast, I think number 4 or so. Jones was very specific about his magical practices being different from his mundane life. And so his magical journals that we have really detail his magical thoughts, his practices, and so forth, but don't talk about his home life, don't talk about the interaction with the children and his wife and things like that. So his approach to it was very different than mine. What I think is important in the end is that you come up with your own process, that you record as much information as you think you need, and I would encourage people to err on the side of recording more than what you think. And really, record everything from your emotions to some people even record what they eat. In Gerald Del Campo's book, New Eon Magic, he talks about in the magical journal recording what you've had for a meal that day, because everything that you consume is then processed into your body, into spiritual substances, and that can have an effect on what you're doing too. And this is not a new idea. If you look back at a lot of the medieval grimoires, when they were doing magical workings, they always said don't eat meat for a few days before so that you don't have the spirit of the animals that you're consuming in you and things like that. So all of these things matter. So I guess I've kind of rambled on enough about that, Will. I hope that's been helpful, and I'm eating up a lot of time. So let me finish up. So thanks to everybody who gave feedback. Please keep it coming. And like I said, the next podcast that's going to have feedback is the April 26th show, which will be the 1 year anniversary show. So I'm looking for feedback in email and specifically the telephone. I want to have as many voicemails as possible from listeners giving comments about the 1 year anniversary. So to get in touch with me, email podcast at thelemacoasttocoast.com. Go to the Thelema Coast to Coast website at www.thelemacoasttocoast.com. You can call the new Thelema Coast to Coast voicemail number, which is 206-600-4216. And you can also send a postcard. Again, anybody who sends a postcard to me, the postcard gets scanned and put on the Thelema Coast to Coast website. And in return, I send you a limited edition Thelema Coast to Coast bumper sticker that has the logo. It says Occultism Without Apologies and has the URL. So those are the ways to get in touch with me. To send the postcard, send it to Thelema Coast to Coast, care of John Crow, P.O. Box 7045, Marietta, Georgia, M-A-R-I-E-T-T-A. Zip code is 30065, and that is in the USA. Okay, so now that I've rambled on for an ungodly amount of time, let's get into the interview. The first one, again, is Richard Kaczynski talking about his book, Panic in Detroit.
We have on the phone with us Richard Kaczynski. Welcome back to the podcast, Richard.
Thank you for having me back.
You have just put out the newest version of the Blue Equinox Journal, number 2, called Panic in Detroit, The Magician and the Motor City. And this is an interesting episode in Crowley's life, I guess actually in the life of the OTO, in which Crowley started a body of the OTO in Detroit and then exploded and even got into the newspapers as a huge expose. Can you just give us a quick summary of what this period of time is about and in general the overall aspects of what are covered in this book?
Sure. What happens, and the story starts with Crowley's trip to America, and he winds up meeting, while he's in New York, a bookstore owner who is very interested in esoteric masonry and was interested in helping Crowley put out the next issue of The Equinox, which was volume 3, number 1. And in addition to helping subsidize the printing of this book, he offers to carry Crowley's books that he was trying to sell in his bookstore, and also offers to introduce him to some like-minded esoteric masons in the Detroit area. And the idea here is that Crowley had promoted this idea that he had taken the degrees of you know, the Scottish Rite and these other rituals, you know, under instructions from John Yarker, and boiled them down into the smaller number of degrees of the OTO, and these masons were interested. So from there, they tried to set up the Wakes region of the OTO, essentially to be the U.S. headquarters, and it winds up not working out for a number of reasons, which the book goes into. And Crowley winds up, you know, going off to chase Luther from the Abbey of Thelema after The Equinox comes out, but there's ramifications that happen because the publishing company that put out the Blue Equinox winds up going bankrupt, and it goes to the bankruptcy courts. And once that happens, this whole involvement of Crowley and the OTO hits the press, which then transforms into this expose of what the press called this, you know, love cult that was in Detroit, and just becomes front page news for a few days in Detroit. It's a lot of newspapers, but it's you know, and it took up a lot of front page real estate. But it kind of hit and then disappeared, and then came back a few months later and disappeared, and just wouldn't go away. So this documents in transcripts of newspaper articles and reproductions of correspondence with Crowley and Father Akkad, this episode.
So when you say they actually started the, or tried to found the OTO in the United States, we actually had at one time Crowley, Akkad, we had Smith, and we had C.F. Russell, all in the Detroit area, working with this group.
Yes.
Not necessarily all at the same time, but in general, trying to get the OTO founded through these people and working in conjunction with the Universal Bookstore.
Yes, in fact, it was amazing because C.S. Jones, or Father Akkad, was living in Detroit for the longest period of time of any of the people you mentioned. He actually worked for the Universal Bookstores in Detroit, and he just got into this really crazy lecture circuit where he was teaching, he was giving classes at the Theosophical Society. He was teaching classes out of his own home, out of the bookstore, just, you know, four nights a week, promoting magic and trying to whip up interest in the Equinox and the OTO.
When Crowley started getting these esoteric Masons involved, he was very conscious of their Freemasonic degree, correct?
Very much so. There are some letters where he talks about how Ryerson, who is his book publisher and distributor, is a 32nd degree Mason, and Crowley remarks he's not going to talk to anyone who's less than a 33rd. So he was very, very much aware of the degrees and wanting to get some high-ranking and influential people involved.
Now, how successful was he initially with that?
Well, there were some problems that he ran into, and this revolved around the fact that Freemasons take oaths to Freemasonry, and when they came to look at the OTO and its initiation rituals, they were too close to the Masonic rituals, and there was a conflict of interest there, and these people said they couldn't go ahead and do these rites because they conflicted with their Masonic oaths. And this prompted Crowley to make some revisions to the preliminary degrees of the OTO to make them less Masonic in flavor. And these are the revisions that, you know, we see echoed in the OTO today. So the changes historically that we've seen in these initiations are due to Crowley trying to get the Church Freemasons on board.
Okay, well, let's take a look at what makes this book so special itself. You have your first chapter, which is your explanation, your historical putting together. Then the second section, can you talk about that a little?
Sure. What's in the second section of the book is a collection of about 45, I believe, letters, either to or from Crowley or Jones, dealing with the Detroit period. So it talks about them meeting the Freemasons, trying to get them involved. There's some really funny quotes in there about, you know, their perspectives on wanting to be Masons, but at the same time wanting to make sure the Masons understand their place in the big scheme of things. And it's exciting because it was an opportunity for me to put out a bunch of letters that have never been published before. So this is, again, some really great source material. And not only do these letters talk about getting the OTO going in Detroit, but it covers a lot of other interesting things in the course of the correspondence as well. Crowley's talking about trying to publish the second issue and the third issue of the Equinox, and that is part of this correspondence, and just various other things that are just a really interesting piece of, you know, where the OTO is at this point in time.
And the subsequent sections after, what did you include there?
Well, let's see, in the subsequent sections, there is a reproduction of the prospectus for Equinox. There is also a collection of transcripts of these newspaper articles, what Ryerson called the mess in the press, so that were newspaper headlines talking about, you know, OTO, you know, trouble laid to OTO cults, and, you know, OTO book leads to wrecked homes, and things like that. So you get to see how very, very quickly this expose in the newspaper goes from, oh, there's this weird cult in Detroit, to, wait a minute, they put out this book. Wait, this book is obscene. This obscene book may have been sent through the mail. Now we're bringing in federal prosecutors. Let's impound the whole bunch of books and determine whether they're obscene. It just gets crazier from there when Hollywood director William Desmond Taylor turns up mysteriously murdered in his home. The fact that he had a copy of White Stains suddenly becomes an OTO connection, and the newspapers start putting out this theory that, you know, the OTO is behind the death of William Desmond Taylor, and just crazy, crazy stuff. But this was all, again, front page news in Detroit at the time it happened.
Ryerson actually, because of all of this, ended up going bankrupt and divorced?
Yes. He actually wound up getting divorced shortly after he met Crowley, and the divorce complaint is actually quite funny because his wife, when she filed for divorce, complained that he feels that he's no longer bound to, you know, to abide by the laws of convention or the society, but to conduct himself in the manner that is consistent with the dictates of his own conscience and will. And, you know, as Thelemites, we would find nothing at all shocking or scandalous about that statement, but it was grounds for divorce in 1918. So, you know, Ryerson, you know, meets Crowley, becomes a Thelemite, gets divorced, and publishes the Equinox, and it wound up not selling as much as, you know, they expected it would. There seems to be much more going on with this story than the Equinox, however, because when the Universal Bookstores went into bankruptcy, the board of directors claimed that they were, you know, that Ryerson had spent like $35,000 publishing the Equinox, and it was nowhere near that amount. So there were bigger financial issues going on, so it's not entirely fair to say that the Equinox or Crowley bankrupted the company. There was more going on, but yeah, things just went from bad to worse in this situation.
And it was pretty smart of Acod and Smith to get out of Detroit before everything blew up.
Yeah, and there's an interesting piece of that story too, which is that before they left town, they had left a bunch of Crowley rare books in a warehouse somewhere that they had completely forgotten about. They didn't even know where it was. And these books sat in the warehouse until 1954, when this crate of books was opened up and people had no idea what it was. So, and that collection, for the most part, wound up down at the University of Texas in Austin. But, you know, it was just these interesting little stories about that come out of that whole Detroit period.
Well, I would love to go on more about this, but we have limited time, so instead, let's recommend everybody go to the Blue Equinox website. What is the URL?
It is www.blueequinox.org.
Okay, and then they can go into the shopping cart area and purchase this, and it's $20 plus shipping.
Correct, and all proceeds from the book do go to back to the Blue Equinox Oasis and to promote its nonprofit goals.
Well, if this is issue number 2, is there an issue number 3 somewhere in the future?
Yes, absolutely. And no plans on what that issue will be. I've got several ideas in mind. It's just a matter of which one bubbles to the top first.
Now, number 2 and number 1 were kind of outtakes from your previous biography, I guess. And that's why number 3 is going to be something completely new?
Yeah, first, well, I really like the idea of putting out original source material for people to be able to have this reference stuff in their libraries. I think it's also important to use this as a vehicle for putting out some original work as well. And I've, you know, got a number of things I'm working on, ranging from the Chaldean oracles to Enochian magic, to the Gnostic Mass, that I don't think have a big enough audience for a mainstream publisher, but through a limited press run like the Blue Equinox Journal, would find enough interested people.
Fantastic. Well, thanks again for being on the podcast, and when the next issue comes out, let us know, and we'll have you back.
Will do. Thank you for having me on the show again.
93.
Again, I want to thank Dr. Kaczynski for being on the podcast. I really appreciate him taking the time and talking about these historical aspects. I think it's very, very important for Thelemites to know the history of Thelema and what Crowley was doing during his lifetime to try to manifest Thelema. So thank you, Dr. Kaczynski. And also on the Thelema Coast to Coast website and in the show notes, I have a link directly to the website where you can buy that book. Again, it's $20 plus shipping. Okay, so now we're going to move forward to the interview with Keith Richmond of Wiser Antiquarian, where we talk about Ray Burlingame and the books that he has for sale through them.
We have on the podcast Keith Richmond from Wiser Antiquarian Books. Welcome to the podcast, Keith, 93.
Hello, John, 93.
Recently, you and a partner purchased Wiser Antiquarian. Can you tell the listeners where you all want to take Wiser Antiquarian?
basically, we've only taken the business over a couple of months ago. My partner, Marilyn, is the long-term manager of Wiser Antiquarian, and I suppose we don't have any dramatic plans to change it, but what we would like to do is really just do what it's done in the past, but a little bit better. We're reinstituting certain old things like the catalogues, which is quite exciting, trying to offer the stock with a bit more context, a bit more of historical background to the books we're selling, that sort of thing, rather than for a number of years we got some fantastic stuff through, but we just put them up for sale on the internet and they'd vanish into obscurity, and yeah, it's sort of, somehow we weren't getting a chance to tell the story along with the books, which often, with books that are historical artifacts, is half the fun.
And you have recently just released your second online catalog, and that is a collection of the books of Ray Burlingame?
That's correct, yes. That's just gone out yesterday.
Can you give a little background to who Ray Burlingame is?
Yes, I can. I suppose before we go into it a little bit, I should just say that what I know about Ray Burlingame is largely plagiarised or borrowed from the works of Martin Starr and Jerry Cornelius. So this is an original resource. I didn't know terribly much about him myself until we got collection. But when we did, researched him a bit, and it is largely drawing from the work of those two authors.
And those, the works that you're talking about in particular, are Martin Starr's The Unknown God, W.T. Smith and the Thelemites?
That's correct, and Jerry Cornelius's biography of Grady McMurtry. So, as you know, Ray Burlingame was a long-time member of the OTO, and joined whilst it was Agape Lodge under W.T. Smith, and was active right through the years with Grady McMurtry, and in fact right up until his death in 1965. That's Burlingame's death.
What positions did Burlingame have in the OTO, or what degree did he get to?
Well, he reached the ninth degree. For a while, he was more or less the de facto leader of a Long Beach branch, apparently. Most of his time, he was in Agape Lodge during the Jack Parsons, W.T. Smith period. And he was a sort of quiet but constant, remarkably constant figure in the order. He pops up in correspondence, really, from when he joined in 1941 right up through his death until his death in 1965. He continued to, even in that period when the OTO was very quiet or almost on the verge of extinction, he was one of the faithful that would contribute to Germer's publication funds. And in fact, he earned Germer's wrath in the later years because he decided to start initiating people himself and take some people into the because he feared that it was on the verge of dying off. So, he was there all the way through, basically, but he's not someone that you hear a lot about.
Was there any other organization that Burlingame was involved in?
Well, he actually started off in C.F. Russell's Gnostic Body of God, which was also known as the Corazon Club, and that, as your listeners may know, is... Russell was a former Crowleyite who went off in his own direction and founded the Corazon Club. He got a lot of, obviously, trouble from Crowley eventually about this, and I think in the mid-30s at some stage effectively disbanded the Corazon Club. And people like Burlingame, there are a number of ex-members who were thus thelemically inclined, interested in magic and quite serious about it, who were looking for something to replace it, and this just happened to be at the time that W.T. Smith was getting Agape Lodge of the OTO organised, so a number of ex-Corazon Club members, including Louis Culling, Burlingame, and a few other of their friends, went over and joined Agape Lodge.
If I remember correctly, there was something about a theft involving the whole Solar Lodge or something in Burlingame after his death. Do you know anything about that?
Not an enormous amount. Basically, one of the Burlingame has an interesting position in the history of the Lima in America, as because of his sort of continuous link almost from this original period of the Agape Lodge right through to the 60s when McMurtry started things up again, and the present incarnation of the OTO really got firing. Towards the end of his life, with Germa not initiating and whatever, as I said, Burlingame did start doing some initiations of his own, including Gene Brayton, who was later associated with the Solar Lodge at the OTO. Apparently, it's rumoured that there were some thefts from Burlingame's library just around the time of his death. They weren't actually reported to police, so there's no real record. Nothing's entirely clear. They're commonly blamed on members of the Solar Lodge, but I don't know that, and they probably were, but no one's really got any absolute evidence. It just, they seem to be the likely figures. So.
Now, when you said you made a catalog, you don't just have an online catalog. You actually printed up a special edition catalog about this collection?
Yeah, that was something especially with this collection. Basically, it's always a little bit sad when you get something like this that is an individual's library where there's a coherence to it. You want to preserve it. On the one hand, it's wonderful to disperse it because a whole load of different people get to enjoy the books. On the other hand, it's a little bit sad to see something intelligently put together broken apart. And we thought, well, one way of preserving the memory of his collection is to do a proper small hard copy catalogue of it, which lists all the books. And at the same time, I was speaking with Martin Starr, who, as we said, is the biographer of W.T. Smith, and I managed to persuade him to write a little piece about Burlingame to put in that catalogue. So we've really, it's basically sort of memoir of Burlingame and a memoir of his library put together, and we just did a very small number of them to give away to the people that bought the books, so they get a sense of the library and the person to whom they once belonged.
Okay. Well, let's talk about a few of the books that are in it, because there are some pretty fascinating editions. Almost all of them are first editions from Crowley, or a first edition of some other kind, like the first U.S. edition of the Book of the Law. The one that I think is probably the most outstanding is one of the 20 copies of Ola, an anthology of 60 years of song.
I think I'd have to agree with you on that. It's an extraordinary book. Basically, that particular one, in fact, most people don't even know that edition exists. It was Crowley's last book published during his lifetime. It was quite literally a swan song, a collection of his favourite pieces of poetry. And as a special edition for friends and helpers, he had 20 copies printed, or a special edition, I should say, of 20 copies on beautiful paper in a magnificent binding which matched the Book of Thoth. I'm sure you, I don't know about the listeners, but you would know that the first edition of the Book of Thoth was perhaps the most magnificent of Crowley's publications. It's leather spine and Egyptian pattern paperboard.
Right.
And it really is a very, very handsome, special book. And this special edition of Ola matched that. Well, apparently it would seem that the story with the Burlingame copy actually was that Burlingame was a great fan. He'd written to Crowley. He was very involved, and he ordered a number of copies of the Book of Thoth. And somehow, somewhere along the line, including, of course, Crowley was going to send him a special inscribed one, half of them didn't show up. There were all sorts of problems, all sorts of aggravations whatever. And eventually, Crowley, as a sort of apology and a thank you, sent him this special copy of Ola, specially inscribed to him, his wife, and their daughter, who was appropriately called Layla. The only problem was, Crowley, we worked out from the date of the inscription, it was the day that he wrote the inscription, and the day he wrote his very last will and testament, he was probably a little under the weather, and he misspelled everyone's names when he wrote. But I think, you know, given his age, given the circumstances, he could probably be forgiven for that.
Right. Now, in the collection is also a Book of Lies. Is that one of the first editions of that, too?
That's right. That's just a very sweet little book. It's obviously, I think, one of Crowley's most interesting works. Like all of Burlingame's books, it's well read. He was very much a practicing magician. The books to him were, you know, they were part of his tools of trade. He read them. This isn't a sort of fine collector's library where the books have never been read. Even the Book of Thoth, which, as I said, is a magnificent thing, and most people would probably virtually put white gloves on before handling it. His has got strange stains, which I suspect are tea. Luckily, they're not too bad, but the odd splash through it, and they've clearly all been worked with. And likewise, the Book of Lies has been pretty well thumbed, but it's still holding in.
Not surprisingly, he also has a first edition volume set 1 through 10 of Equinox Volume 1. What shape is that in? Is that also in a very red shape?
Yes, I think they almost always are, though. The Equinox, oddly, wasn't particularly strongly bound in the trade edition, and Crowley liked this particular Holland Bact, I think it's called. It's a rather flimsy sort of linen spine on them, and virtually all copies that you see of that have been are starting to fall apart, or at best been knocked around. And in fact, Ray Burlingame set isn't too bad at all, but it's just a set of books that never shows up in great condition.
Right.
They just weren't, oddly, they weren't designed to last. Or if they were, I think he intended it, but there was some lapse between the intention and the actuality. So.
Now, on this podcast, we also have an interview with Dr. Richard Kaczynski about his new book, The Panic in Detroit. It's kind of the story about the founding of the OTO in Detroit, as well as the efforts to get the Equinox Volume 3, Number 1 published. And similarly, that edition is in the Burlingame collection.
That's right. And again, that's actually been extremely well read, which isn't surprising because it was a very significant volume. As I'm sure you know, it had some very important texts of Crowley's in it. And it would have been much used in the Agape Lodge and circle, so definitely Ray Burlingame's copy has been much used. But it's again, luckily, that was very stoutly bound. They must have learnt from the first series that perhaps these paper boards and cloth spines weren't the best idea, and when they got around to doing the 3-1, the so-called blue equinox, they'd learnt their lesson and put a good solid blue cloth binding.
The one book that I was coveting was the full unedited edition of Magic Without Tears, although I've seen it has already been sold.
Sadly, that went rather quickly. That's a hard one to find.
Yeah. Well, are there any other books that you think are worth mentioning?
To my mind, most of the books are interesting. They're all fascinating in their way. I mean, I'm a great fan of Crowley's writing, and I can see merit to all of them, but really what's most interesting is their history, the fact that they did belong to Ray Burlingame, and that a lot of them have his ownership in inscriptions have been used by him. One of them, I think, the collected works, I was just looking at it and I realised that rubbed out on the inside front cover is Regina Carl's ownership signature, and she was the first woman, as far as I know, to perform the Gnostic Mass in certainly in the Agape Lodge, probably in America, and a very interesting person in her own right, and obviously this had passed from her to Ray at some stage. I think really what's perhaps special above all about them to me is just that historical link with someone who really was there quietly in the background, but for all those years when, and from the sort of the real growth, start of growth with Agape Lodge through the sort of slow decline under Germa, and then just at the very end when Grady McMurtry was starting to pick things up again. So that's probably the real joy to it.
Well, fantastic. I really appreciate you being on the show and talking about Ray and the books that have come up for sale. I will put a link on the show notes for people who want to take a look at the catalog, and there are pictures of each of the books. So even though they may be out of someone's price range, I know they're out of mine. But,
yeah, well, and mine. Believe me, if I had my way, I'd be keeping them all. So I could say that with absolute honesty. So, yes, but it's nice to at least have a look at them. I also should just say, if I may, while I think of it, you mentioned the Solar Lodge, and one very exciting thing that I've just become aware of is that Martin Starr's written an essay on the Solar Lodge, which is going to appear in an academic journal called Pomegranate in the May issue. And to my mind, I think a lot of people have... The Solar Lodge has always been an enigma. There's been a lot of things written about it, a lot of ill-informed, misinformed, whatever. The truth's never come out about what exactly, who they were, where they came from, all that type of thing. Now, if anyone knows it or at least can make a positive contribution towards it, that would be Martin. So, and as I said, in his own strange way, you know, Ray Burlingame played an important part in that. So so that may well be something your listeners will be interested in, might want to watch out for, and I'll happily give you some more information about that when the time comes, where they can find that journal and such like.
Fantastic. Well, thank you very much for being on the show, and maybe when the next catalog comes out and there's another interesting collection of books, you can come back on the show and tell us about it.
Be my pleasure.
Thanks again. 93.
Thanks, John. 93. Bye.
I want to thank Keith Richmond for being on the podcast again. I really appreciate him taking the time. The books are really, really fascinating to look at. I had not seen a lot of the first edition books, and so if you go to the link on the Thelema Coast to Coast website that goes to the Wiser catalog, it's got a picture of each of the books, the spine, the front, and so forth. It's really fascinating to see what each of the first editions look like. So now we're going to go to the interview with Keith 418. Keith and I are going to talk about mentoring, and Keith is going to be answering particular questions given by a listener.
Keith, welcome back to the podcast, 93.
93, John. Thanks for having me.
Earlier, I read some feedback from some listeners, and they were talking about some of the practical aspects of magic, and I gave some responses. But there was one listener feedback that I wanted to read directly to you and get your response, as I think you're probably better suited to give some comments. It's from Scott in California. He says, "Dear John, do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. I'm a great fan of the show. I have listened to all the podcasts so far and eagerly await new ones. Your excellent interviews and great lectures are at once entertaining and informative. Thank you for being such a vital and relevant resource for the Thelemic community. I had an opportunity to experience the Gnostic Mass for the first time at Therion Babylon Encampment, OTO, and I was also able to meet Keith 418 there. He is an interesting fellow with much to say. I was moved by the beauty and power of the ritual. I was surprised with how much I resonated with the celebration of the Mass. I am, however, looking for a teacher that can help guide me through some beginning work. In Liber E, Crowley states, during the whole of this elementary study and practice, he will do wisely to seek out and attach himself to a master, one competent to correct him and advise him, nor should he be discouraged by the difficulty for finding such a person. I would greatly appreciate any information about where to look for teachers and how to evaluate their worthiness. I'm already aware of the potential benefits of joining the OTO insofar as broadening my ability to accomplish this goal of finding a teacher, so other resources would be useful. Thank you for your consideration in this matter, and I look forward to listening to your podcast for some time to come. Love of the law, love under will, Scott. What are your thoughts about finding a teacher and attaching to them and determining whether they're competent to correct them and advise them?
Well, I think it's interesting to go back and look at what Crowley himself had to say about this. And I think it's something that a lot of people kind of miss. You know, our society right now doesn't have a lot of role models that are positive for people. I mean, a lot of times because of divorce, because of a poor educational system, young people don't often find mentors, people that they can really look up to. And many people, I think, coming to the occult community are seeking a teacher, they're seeking a mentor, a lot of them are seeking parental figures of one kind or another. And I think you need to be really clear about what you're looking for yourself and to develop a sort of sense of self-honesty about that. Because if you're really looking for a father figure or a mother figure or someone to sort of nurture you in a way that maybe you didn't get when you were a kid, you're not going to find that in the real occult community. You may find it in the fake occult community, in the nonsense occult community. You're not going to find that in the real occult community. And the more serious you are, the more serious you have to be about what exactly it is you're looking for. And I think people would be wise if they went back and looked at Crowley's own experiences with people like Oscar Eckenstein, who was not an occultist. You know, he was just a smart guy that Aleister Crowley met during his mountain climbing days, that Crowley happened to learn a lot from and who he regarded as one of his most important teachers. And essentially, Crowley tells us, and people should look this up themselves, but he tells us a teacher is really anyone who knows how to do something you don't. So if I, for example, wanted to learn how to fix a carburetor on a 1965 Mustang, I would need to find a mechanic who was really good at fixing Mustangs from that period and knew how to fix a carburetor or change one out and work on it. And that guy could be, you know, someone who I totally disagreed with politically, who may have had, you know, crazy attitudes about a host of different social and economic issues, but as long as he knew how to do this thing that I didn't know how to do, he would be my teacher, and I would respect him and listen to him and do what he told me to do and learn from him how to change the carburetor. And when we do occult stuff, we shouldn't really change our attitudes around from that. We're just looking for people who know how to do things we don't know how to do. And investing it with a lot of, you know, emotional nonsense, I think, only sort of confuses the issue. So in the end, what a lot of times people are looking for is someone who will nurture them and support them and tell them that they're good people. And in turn, the teachers are looking, or in quotes, I say that, you know, ironically, the teachers are so-called teachers are looking for people to come and ratify their egos and tell them how great they are. And it becomes a sort of mutual reinforcing process, which has nothing to do with magic or real occultism. And this is why, you know, you find people who are very defensive about their teachers and their schools and their lineages and this and that, who don't know anything. And the reason they don't know anything is they're not there to really learn anything. They're there to get this sort of emotional support and reinforcement and ego stroking and everything else. And I think that's disgusting.
Well, one of the interesting aspects about this is that section where they are competent to correct and advise. Well, that right there shows that A, there is an objective way to determine somebody's competence, and that you have to be able to judge whether or not that person is competent.
Right. You have to be able to tell whether or not the guy really knows how to fix the carburetor in the 1965 Mustang, or whether he doesn't, or whether she doesn't.
Well, and conversely, the teacher has to be able to judge the student to correct the student.
That's
and if
correct.
Somebody is saying, well, you can't judge me, you know, who are you to make any determinations about this or that, well, then they've already cut themselves off from somebody being able to help them.
Uh-huh. That's correct. That is right. And again, it becomes more of this, as I keep saying, this emotional sort of parent figure or cult leader or, you know, person who's there to magically reinforce you as a good person, and it's less anything to do with can you move from point A to point B. And, you know, this is why I think it's really important often for teachers and students to not like each other all that much or to be frustrated with each other on certain levels, because that way it takes it away from the personality of the person and back to the task at hand. I mean, the teacher who can get you, if you're trying to do yoga work, to samadhi, to help you get to samadhi faster than anything else is the best teacher, regardless of whether they're complete slime or not. You know, they could be horrible people on moral or ethical levels and very offensive, but if they can get you to samadhi quickly, they're the best teacher for you. Whereas the really sweet, nice guy that everybody loves, who's giving and supportive and emotionally connected and progressive and liberal and loving, if he doesn't know anything about yoga, he's a terrible teacher.
Well,
this is what people in the community are completely missing. So, you know, if you want to try to determine whether someone's a good teacher or not, focus on the thing you're trying to learn. Don't focus on these other issues. And be clear about what it is you're looking for.
Well, you also have to be very committed to that objective end.
Yes.
Because if you go in wanting a friend or a father figure or somebody, you know, to say great things about you, and they don't, if you're not committed to that, you're going to walk away, not have gained anything, and lost the potential for learning.
Right, and you're going to tell everybody, oh, that guy doesn't know what he's talking about, you know, he's a jerk or whatever, yeah. Yeah, so I think that's really getting down on the same page with what you're really trying to do. That's the most essential issue. And again, I mean, I think people need to look at this in terms of the books they read and the material that they're looking at. Are they looking at things that are just going to reinforce them and make them feel good about themselves, or are they going to look at things that really challenge them and may irritate them and make them unhappy on a certain level? And, you know, a lot of times the teachers that we've had in life who have not put up with our crap and have been very, very tough have been the best teachers and the people we've learned the most from. And the teachers, you know, that we like, that we have this you know, this love and affection for, but who really, you know, didn't really push us, those are not the teachers that we want. And again, I mean, I think that, you know, people have to be very clear about what they're really after here. And a lot of times people aren't. I mean, a lot of times the people in the occult community are lying to themselves about what their real motivations are and what they're really after, what they're really seeking. So you're not going to get anywhere if you're lying to yourself about it to begin with.
And so how do you think people should evaluate the worthiness of their teachers?
Well, I think they need to find people who can do things they can't do. And one of the scariest things in the occult community, I think, one of the most frightening aspects of it, is that there are a lot of people out there presenting themselves as teachers who really don't know how to do too much more than their most beginning student knows how to do. They haven't read a lot of the material. They haven't studied it deeply. They haven't done a lot of the practices. Maybe they're older. Maybe they've been around the scene longer. But, you know, when it really comes to their experience and what they know how to do well, they're not really that much more advanced than their most, you know, naive beginning student. So you need to find people who really impress you as being knowing how to do a lot of stuff and not just talking a good game, but, you know, really showing it. You also have to look for, I think, people who are not seeking students, which is weird, because most of the time the people seeking students are just seeking a cult following to ratify their egos. And if you find teachers who basically tell you, screw you, go away, I don't have time for you, get out of here, that teacher, because they're very busy with their own work, may be the best teacher for you to find. And you have to prove to them that you're worthy of doing this. There's a wonderful Japanese film from the 50s about this kid who goes to a dojo to study judo, and the teacher tells him to take a hike to get lost. And every single day he comes back, and every single day the teacher tells him to leave. And one night he stands in the pond next to the school all night long to prove that he's really determined and wants to do it. And then after that, the teacher lets him in and starts training him. And I think that this is something people need to pay attention to, because if you go around aligning yourself with people who are looking for students, oftentimes those people, I mean, nearly all the time, in my opinion, those people are looking for ego ratification, and they're looking for followers, but they don't really have anything to teach other than how to set up a little ego ratification cult with occult trappings around it. So find the people that are really involved in their task. I mean, if you go to a university, for example, and you want to study physics, you really go and find the teacher who's most involved with his physics experiments, who's at the very top of his game, and you pressure and bug that teacher to show them that you will help them with their work as an associate student, as a, you know, fellow experimenter, and they'll let you in and start training you. But if they're really busy, they're going to be busy with their thing. They're not going to be busy with, you know, making you feel good about yourself, or making up for the father that you didn't ever had, or, you know, making up for the fact that you have all these psychological problems. That's not what they're going to be interested in. They're interested in doing their physics experiment. So occult teachers are no different. You know, most of them are so busy doing their thing, they don't have time for students, especially the occult students who won't do any work. I mean, you and I have talked about this, but people in the occult community will not work. They won't read the books they're supposed to read. They won't do the exercises they're supposed to do. Nowadays, they won't even buy the books they're supposed to buy. You've run into this, haven't you?
Yes. Yes.
We tell people to read books, and they just look at us like, what, are you crazy? I mean, I had this one case where this guy was complaining about all the books on the AA reading list, the short list, the list in the back of Book 4, Part 2. And I said to him, you are a lawyer. How many books did you have to read to pass the bar exam? Why are you complaining about the books? You want to be magus of the universe, and you're complaining about a tiny number of books compared to the books you had to read to be a mediocre lawyer. That's craziness to me. But that's what we run into all the time. So one of the most important things is to see whether they'll read the material or not, whether they'll study it. And, you know, a lot of times people will say, well, I don't read well, or I read very slowly, or I don't do well with reading. Too bad. You know, any really good teacher is going to make you do a certain amount of reading to get that intellectual common language down, because that's just the start of it. The whole occult task is not reading books, it's doing things. But if you don't do the reading, forget about it. And that's the saddest thing, is I've seen in the community these days, is so many people who think everything's up on the Internet so they don't have to read anything. You've run into this too, haven't you?
Yes. Well, the other thing that people need to keep in mind, I think, is that all of the tasks and work that you're going to have to do are not going to seem directly connected to the object at hand, but it all fits together in the end.
Right. Well, it depends. I mean, it's the thing that they have to figure out. A lot of times when you're starting out with occult work, you don't know what it is that you're going to do. I mean, one friend of mine who's very bright when it comes to these issues keeps saying that occult work is not any different from college. Sooner or later, you have to pick a major. You have to find an area within the occult world that you're going to concentrate in, because occultism, you know, in and of itself is a nearly infinite sort of field. I mean, there's very many, many, many different areas of study. And what's disappointing to me, and sort of an indication that people aren't really getting it, is meeting people who've been in the community for 20 years and don't have a major yet.
Mm-hmm.
They know a little bit about this, a little bit about that, but their area of concentration, the thing that they are the most focused on, isn't really apparent. And that's pathetic. I mean, no one is a student for 20 years at a college and doesn't have a major. You pick a major, and the earlier on you pick your major and you focus and you find a thing that you can spend the rest of your life working on, the better off you're going to be. And that's going to help you find a teacher, because that's going to help you show the direction you want to go in. But a lot of times when you're just starting out, you don't always know what that thing is going to be. So you get a wide, you know, you get a wide palette of experiences, you get a wide palette of information. And from that work and those experiences, you pick the thing that you're going to work on. If your teacher doesn't seem to have a major, that's a mistake. Another thing I would urge people to check for is fakers. There's people, especially around here locally, that I kind of find entertaining, who have come to the conclusion that if they act like adepts all the time, people will think that they are. So they walk around with these very serious expressions and this very sort of deep kind of aching world on my shoulders sort of attitude, and they're basically faking what they think an adept is like. And it can be very successful in fooling people, but, you know, you have to kind of pierce through that and see, where's the beef here? Where's the real deal? What do these people really have to teach? And if they're just putting on an act, you know, you should be smart enough to see that pretty quickly.
Well, the other thing is, people don't have to make a decision quickly. They can spend a lot of time working with a person without dedicating themselves to
that
master.
Yeah, and they should have the same attitude that Crowley, you know, says that they should have, which is to, you know, to evaluate and to look skeptically on what people say. I mean, the weirdest thing about this, and I think you'll agree with me about this, is that in a cult movement which validates independent thought and scientific skepticism, we have a tremendous number of people who operate completely on faith and show no skepticism whatsoever. You know, I don't understand that. I mean, I don't understand the slavish obedience to authority in the OTO, which often just looks like craven submission and the most disgustingly slavish attitudes, given what Crowley says about how we should be evaluating our teachers. We should be looking at them skeptically. We should be making them prove that they can do what they say they can do.
Right.
But yet again, in the occult community, we find people who are really kind of looking for masters. They're slaves looking for masters. And there's a lot of people out there that are looking for a little tribe of goons and a little, you know, cult to follow them around. And they're gonna find that if that's what they're looking for. I think it's disgusting, but that's me.
Well, that about wraps it up for today. Is there anything else you want to add?
Oh, no, not at all.
All right, well, thanks again for being on the podcast.
Thank you for having me, John.
93.
All right. Well, that about wraps up this podcast. I want to thank both Keiths and Richard for being on the show. I want to thank all the listeners who make this a success, in particular, the ones who give feedback. I'm not going to be doing a CD giveaway on this podcast just because of the time constraints and some of the other logistics with that. The 26th, I'm actually going to have an interview with the owner of Latex Records, and we're going to be giving a CD away on that one. So, but Latex Records is still a sponsor, and I'm going to be closing with a song of theirs, a remix of a song called Jackal Head by the band Kali Yuga. I really, really love this song. Kali Yuga has recently just put out a new CD, and Latex is distributing that. On a future podcast, I will be playing those songs. But for now, I am going to be playing Kali Yuga's Jackal Head. And just before I go, I want to point out to everybody that loshtal.com is now offering a free blog service using, I think, the WordPress software. So if you were thinking of making a blog, they have one, and it's free. And I strongly encourage everybody to support loshtal.com. It's a wonderful online resource for Thelemites, a great place for people to get together and discuss things. And now it's a wonderful place to have your blog. All right. Well, thanks again for listening. And don't forget the Holy Days podcasts are coming up this weekend. I'm going to be releasing each one on each day. So thanks again for listening. Love is the law. Love under will.
Well, the podcast is almost over. Now what are you going to do?
Look for porn.
See, that's what you get when you raise your child to be a pagan.
You son of a... Your mom sucks.
All right, you two. That's quite enough.
I'm sorry. Was it the pagan remark?
Actually, it probably was. But you can make up for it by tuning into Circle of Souls Pagan Radio.
Kick ass.
Yes, it does. Just surf on over to CircleOfSouls.net. Circle of Souls Pagan Radio.
Proportion. Later, it was discovered that knee seismic activity was linked to an RP launch on December was a myth.